Hey, you're listening to The Morning Show with Aaron. That was Karanga by Taisha Tari. And on the line, I've got Ngaronoa Renata. Good morning.
Atamari koutou ma.
Last time we met, we were at Treaty of Waitangi workshop that Raglan Naturally put on. That must be 3 or 4 weeks ago now that we did that, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was quite a full gathering, I thought, in the church hall in Stewart Street.
And have you been to them before? I thought you might be like a regular fixture or something.
But well, actually, those treaty workshops aren't specifically for someone like myself. They were designed to educate tangata tiriti, which are the partners of the treaty.
Such as myself, I guess.
I did feel the inspiration to attend in terms of being with our own community, hapuri, in that setting. And certainly it was quite an incredible day as the day unfolded with the delivery of the actual process that was being given to our community to absorb that information or those facts.
Yeah, I must admit I was being
shared.
I was worried that it was going to be an all-day workshop, an all-day information dump, and that my poor old brain wouldn't be able to remember everything that I was being told. But it was not 8 hours of being lectured. We were taking on a journey. It wasn't just facts we were given. I say we had an experience, which I think makes it much easier to recall what you've learned, and it kind of locks it in a lot better.
I think the whole design of the way that the kaupapa unfolded had been refined.
Yeah.
To include a number of different ways of delivering and for us to take on board the significance, the historical significance of that usually misinterpreted history that is really essential to who we are as a dual cultural heritage.
Yeah.
I'm very impressed.
Yeah, and it was like not only did I learn a lot from it, but like I really enjoyed the experience. And at one level, I would just recommend it to people as an experience that's worth doing. Sometimes you go to Rainbow's Den, sometimes you go to a movie, sometimes you go to the theatre, sometimes you go surfing, and sometimes you might go to this kind of treaty workshop. And it's much more meaningful than some of those other things, though, because of what it's about. Takeaway, if anyone takes one thing away from this from me, is that it's really, really worth doing.
Absolutely. And I also think that the home people who were actually the kaitiaki of that kaupapa through Raglan Naturally did a brilliant job in holding that space as well. And that's really important. So there was not a no blame situation. It was really an unfolding of those moments of like, oh, I didn't know that. Oh, okay. And really the historical events that were being shared and given to us were very factual and genuine. So you couldn't not believe them really in their entirety because of the honesty and the way that they were shared. But they were pretty hard-hitting as well.
Yeah, there was... there's a lot of revelations for people, it's interesting for me that as someone who pays a lot of attention to what's going on in the world politically and in the media and has for a long time, and how confused I was about some aspects of the treaty, like there's really important aspects of it that just the information hasn't got out through the media, and I can barely understand how they've managed to do it in such a way as to keep us confused. But as someone who pays a lot of attention, I was confused about some things. I was sort of aware there were two versions of the treaty, Te Tiriti, which was literally what it says on the top, that was in the Maori language and then the English language version as well. And they have very different things to say about sovereignty, which has obviously led to a few problems. But I guess the main thing that I didn't get, no one had ever explained to me or I'd never picked up, was that the point of the treaty from the Māori perspective was that Māori leadership would continue to run the country the way they always had, but there would be an English governor to keep control of. They're particularly having trouble with some of the sailors, as was given as an example. So the governor was there to govern just the Pākehā, and then that was how the country was set up, so that the English governor would govern the Pākehā and the Māori leadership would govern Māori people and Māori land. That's a real simple thing.
Well, the thing is that at that pivotal time in the history of the colonising of Aotearoa New Zealand, the colony was actually operating from Parramatta and Sydney, and they had already established a colony where people had been thrown out of England.
Yes.
And so they were placed in jails in New South Wales. So the colony was moving already in this side of the world in terms of close to Aotearoa, and their bridging to come to have a trading relationship was essential, and that was going on long before the treaty was even formed.
Yeah.
And because of the way that the sailors and the whalers and sealers were coming into the country, mainly through the South Island, there seemed to be a lot of lawlessness that
yeah.
was very unacceptable to the indigenous people of who were in Aotearoa and had been there for hundreds of years. So naturally there was this, oh, well, we must tell the colony, you know, that their people are really, really playing up very badly and they need to come and govern them. Mm.
And there was initially some reluctance. Well, what was the people in Australia saying? Like the governor over there was a bit impossible for him. Was that? I can't quite remember.
So the governors that were operating were obviously appointed from England, and they could leave their position at any time and return to England, and then another governor would be appointed depending on the current politics of the time. So the Aboriginal people never got any discussions with the colony, with the English who were setting up. There was no sitting at a round table talking about the sovereignty of the Aboriginal people at all. And there's very little recorded about that as well in terms of archival material. It's held in different ways, but definitely there's no written records or not comprehensive records.
Yeah.
So they were really looking forward to colonising Aotearoa, which is how the Declaration of Independence came about in 1835 on the 28th of October. And then that led into the treaty and the writing of the treaty in English and Māori. As the colony was establishing, they also had a school in London where you could learn Māori and English, because what they knew very earlier on was they then had to translate oral Māori into an English alphabet.
Mm. Yeah, and there's lots to unpack here. I want to talk about the Declaration of Independence, but I also just want to go back to the bit about the amount of trouble that was being caused by sailors and runaway convicts in this country. And I think the way it was explained at the treaty workshop was that they weren't really recognising Māori authority, and it was thought that they needed to see a policeman, they needed to see a court, like a jailhouse, a court, and a hangman's noose. And a graveyard. They needed to see all those things to believe that there were consequences to their actions, I think. That's my kind of explanation of what I was told. So that that was kind of how serious, I think that's how serious people were taking the problem and why the governor was first appointed. But we should definitely talk about the Declaration of Independence, because I was vaguely aware of that, but I didn't really know what that was all about.
Yeah, so it is an international declaration. It's a Declaration of Independence, and it was signed on the 28th of October in 1835. And there is a flag that has been associated with it. However, they are actually two separate entities. The flag that is considered to be associated with the Declaration of Independence was developed because a flag was required to on a ship that was trading internationally, and that came from the colony, from the British. So that was actually four or five flags were designed in Sydney by the flag makers, and Māori chiefs chose from those flags which one that they would accept and fly in regards to flying on a ship that was conducting international trade. And it was not only with Australia, it was with other countries as well that trade was being developed.
To be clear to people, Māori had by this point purchased their own ships to do trade.
Absolutely.
That was something I didn't like. That's not something I knew. Like my knowledge about pre-treaty Aotearoa is pretty limited. The period when, by the looks of things, there was a good relationship between Māori and Pākehā, and a lot of cross-pollination, exchanging of ideas and technology, and like mutually beneficial relationship. And Māori had started to get their own ships and were trading. And was it the case that one of their ships, before there were flags, got impounded or something in Sydney?
Yes, that's true. And I guess it was an example of that the flying of a flag was a very serious was a requirement. And if you didn't, you know, this is what happens to a ship with cargo. So yes, that did happen in Puihakina in Sydney. And it was, the flag was taken very seriously, and it was adopted as well, straight away to be, to operate in that way for trading. Māori were very entrepreneurial. Mm. Long before the treaty was written, there was conversations and travel that took place between Aotearoa and England, and several trips were made by mainly the chiefs.
Yeah,
the chiefs who would travel with their sons to the colony, to where the heads, as you say, the governor was governing from, because that's how they saw it. Was you have direct contact with those who are leading your people.
Yeah. We should describe the flag too. People will know it. It's the one with St. George's Cross, the English flag, and so St. George's Cross in the middle, and then, correct me if I'm wrong, I think there's four stars, something in the top left corner. I need to bring it up on a screen.
Yeah, so
now,
in the left-hand corner, it's sort of in four quarters. The left-hand corner, those four stars, which are four eight-pointed stars,
yep,
they represent the Te Pai Mahutunga, which is the Southern Cross. So that's to really clearly indicate that it's a constellation, of course, which is significant in the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah, yeah.
So Te Pai Mahutunga is its name. And it's actually very significant. That cluster of stars was given to a very significant mental health model, Māori health model that was developed, is called Te Pai Mahutunga. But that's a side.
And the flag is sometimes called the United Tribes of New Zealand flag. I'm just reading off Wikipedia now. Hopefully that's right.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, there's a lot of very accurate information around its what its intention was, and the English and Māori versions are very clear. It's a forerunner to the Treaty of Waitangi.
And something they said at the workshop was that they chose the St. George's Cross to show that Māori were allied with England.
I think the whole St. George's Cross mythology is quite a big one. It goes right through Europe. It's not specific to England.
Yeah,
because there was and that whole, people go, oh, was there a dragon? I said, probably. There's always a dragon somewhere in English, English history.
Yeah.
And it was a saint, St. George, of course. Yeah.
And I want to just, so we said before that this came about at a similar time to the Declaration of Independence, but they weren't specifically related. But I think we need to emphasise more about the Declaration of Independence, or in some ways it's more accurately translated, they said, as Declaration of Sovereignty.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly where a lot of the legal discussions are always taking place, and the misinterpretation is around language.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember clearly that morning at our workshop that's what we started with, was words and what they would mean, what we thought they meant. You know, like words we take for granted, like tauiwi, Pākehā, treaty, and, you know, there was a really good, really good explanation of what those words actually translate to be.
Yeah.
And that's where it all starts and hasn't really stopped, is the actual interpretation of translations.
I mentioned before how the two versions of the treaty, Te Tiriti and the treaty, have different things to say, unfortunately. And then also I learned that the 1975 Treaty of Waitangi Act instructs the Waitangi Tribunal to take into account both versions of the treaty, which it's got to be difficult when in one particular area they say completely opposite things. One said sovereignty was going to the Queen and the other said sovereignty was staying with Māori leadership and Māori people. I actually don't know how the tribunal has accommodated that.
Well, the fact of the matter is the treaty, the Waitangi Tribunal is a government department. It's been formed by the coloniser. That's where it sits.
Mm.
So that's a really important part of understanding. It's not an independent of the law, English law. It's not outside of that.
Yeah.
So it was appointed by the Crown to represent. However, that in itself can be problematic because the baseline that is used is always what is the current, what they call the law. And then within that body of law, there is also the words come up which are called the common law, and that's another requires another whole understanding where that sits within the English law system.
And it's like whose common law is it as well?
Well, it's English. It belongs to the English.
Yeah.
They developed the common law.
Yeah, mm. Yeah. We didn't get into really controversial stuff, but it does raise questions about the legitimacy of the New Zealand government at this time, that it's because it's not actually based on the treaty, like it wouldn't, or Te Tiriti, it's not actually based on that. And I imagine that there are people out there who see the current situation as being completely illegitimate. What are you aware of?
Oh, so the... the treaty itself was also then taken to the United Nations for a hearing. So outside of the law of the colony so that it could also get a hearing in that setting where others, you know, internationally could look at it.
Yeah.
And look at its the rights of Indigenous people according to the treaty. And I think that was that's part of the story and a part of an important story that on an international level, where does it sit and legally?
Yeah.
You know, as a constitution.
And that's as an objective.
As a founding document.
Yeah, and that's looking at it objectively from the outside, I guess you could say. What was the conclusion? Do we have a conclusion?
Well, we do have a conclusion which plays out every day. So what happens is what is currently experienced in Aotearoa New Zealand is one of the treaty partners is very well off and the other treaty partner is actually in a state of, you know, economic bereft because of the lack of honouring of that agreement, of that constitutional agreement. So every day that plays out, so you have the treaty partner, one is actually flourishing and doing very well, thank you very much, and the other treaty partner, it does not have that same balance of to enjoy the resources, the kaunga of its own country, which is just a very strange way to live historically. I mean, I feel it in my bones, really. But I'm very aware that there is a very privileged class who belong to the other treaty group who live within, can't really see outside of that wealth that they experience, that wealth was never theirs originally anyway. It was deliberately a breach. It's a breach of the treaty agreement.
So I was wondering if I don't know, but when it was taken to the UN, was there like a determination or a legal opinion or something like that? That's what I was trying to find out. I don't know if either of us know or can speak to that.
And so you bring it to the attention of the United Nations, then they can also look at it and different aspects of it. So not only do you allow it to breathe in the international arena, but then there are stories within the treaty that also become an issue in their entirety. So they get taken as well. As you know, the one at the one in Tamaki around Mangere Mountain, they took that specific issue for that land, that specific what was going on there, and took that to the United Nations. But they couldn't have done that without the previous work that had been done to ensure that the treaty, our treaty, was heard on the international arena in the United Nations. So, yeah, it's an ongoing conversation.
So the UN is acknowledging the negative impact of our history, obviously, and I guess
yes, it has a role to play. However, some would say it's quite a twisted role that they also have lost the that, how do you say, that balance of really understanding the what their purpose, their original purpose was. So there's also that too. You know, they're not the only forum, but they definitely are a forum that have been used to be heard.
Yeah, I think one of the important things in terms of, we talked before about how there's the English and Māori versions of the treaty are different. Legally speaking, I think it's generally accepted around the world now that if you write a treaty and the two language versions are different, and most treaties are between people of different languages, then it's whoever wrote the treaty, it's against them. The mistake, if it's a mistake or a deliberate, doesn't matter, it's against them. So it's always decided in favour of the partner of the in the treaty who didn't write it, who wasn't responsible for the mistake.
Right. I don't think there was mistakes.
No, well, I don't.
Yeah, the mistakes are actually in the interpretation, and which one is the, and do we accept both of them? Do we accept one of them? You know, do they sit alongside each other? There was no mistake. It's actually in the interpretation of the wording that we choose to have very long, lengthy discussions with lawyers. And that's the problem, really. When you've only got you treat it as just a legal document, but it's also considered to be a spiritual document, a document that has a spiritual base, and that's very hard to densify in terms of those who think, "Oh, what does that mean?" But it's very, very clearly understood by Māori. It's a covenant. It's like a covenant, you know, and that. Where have we heard the word covenant? It's a form of a covenant. You know, the Jewish people had a covenant. So it's a very ancient word in that sense, that it has a meaning, a very clear meaning around a spiritual relationship with another group of people. And that has been ripped apart in so many ways. It's very unfortunate.
Can I ask you about some work that your father has done, Ngāpuhi Speaks, that was brought into the discussion? Can you just tell us what that is and how that relates to the treaty discussion?
So Ngāpuhi Speaks is a really important document because it was written at a time, at a really, really potent time in the history of Ngāpuhi, and the northern people wanted to have a published work, wanted work to be published about what they understood to be the case. And so those key rangatira, you know, spent many days and many hours rewriting and presenting the history so that it wasn't, how do you say, Māori felt that they'd always been like in a glass house, and the people outside the glass house were telling the story about those who lived in the glass houses.
Mm.
And that was first considered to be very offensive. Like, you can't write about us. You don't live how we live. You don't know our story. But that was the only version that had been publicly made available.
Yeah.
Because that's how you colonize the people. You take away the right for them to tell their own stories. So Ngāpuhi Speaks is about Ngāpuhi rangatira actually articulating their own understandings and publishing it in a way that it cannot be mistaken what was understood. And so I think that's a really important scholarly piece of work that we can, you know, receive some insight into what did Māori think, how were they thinking, you know, what did we have a view as well, because the view of the treaty partner, in this case the colonizer, was very, very the language that was used, you know, originally, to even the way that they spoke about Māori, you know, in the early school journals, they were called savages, Māori.
Mm.
And to us now, we look at that word and we go, oh my gosh, that's how you, the perception, you know, the English referred to Māori as natives and as savages. So once again, then you get that languaging. So Māori had to reclaim that through this story that was being told. Ngāpuhi Speaks was really to send a very clear message that we have our own voice and we want to be heard.
And so it's presented basically Māori worldview, but particularly in relation to the history of Aotearoa, the treaty, sovereignty and rights and things like that. Would that be, I'm guessing
very,
a little bit.
Very specifically related to the Declaration of Independence and the treaty, and very factual, very, very clearly, you know, putting down a story that's not heard so easily, because it's not the one that, you know, is in the public arena as such and spread throughout the country, but it's a very valuable publication that needs to be given more attention so that people can understand what Māori were thinking or how they think as well.
Yeah. Someone I'd like to understand what they're thinking is David Seymour from the ACT Party, who's the one who is saying that we need to have a vote on what we think of the treaty. And there's lots of debate about this, but I sort of feel like most of the debate is... Oh, what's happening? I don't know.
Oh, no, that's all right. That's just me. I'm good.
Yes. Okay. So, yeah, I was going to say, to me, the debate is a fairly quick one because a treaty is, as we all know, between two parties. And if one party wants to change the document, the other party has to agree to it, and one party can't just change it, which is effectively like the New Zealand government is often referred to as the crown. They're representing historically Queen Victoria and the line that came down through there into the New Zealand government, so they can have a referendum and they can say things like that, but I can't see how it would have any legal standing whatsoever. You either have the treaty and both parties agree, or you break the treaty and then I don't know what happens after that. Well, no, we do, because it's been broken consistently. But at this point in time, when we're much clearer about what Te Tiriti says, I just feel like it's a political stunt that David Seymour's doing, and I've watched him get interviewed, and he's very slippery. He's a very dishonourable man, I would say. It's not the type of language I normally use to use phrase. I don't know. What's happening?
No, sorry. That's my car's doing something. I don't know what it's doing.
Oh, okay.
That's good.
Yeah.
Those things are actually deliberately put in there to create, if you like, a delay in settlements, a perception that, you know, Māori are holding up the process of, you know, like the treaty claims. It's always about driving a perception that, oh, why don't they just get on with it? Why don't they just, you know, we've already done that. Why do we have to do it again? But it's, you know, and so those we're used to those. We're kind of, in the Māori world, we're very aware of... of people like that who really don't have enough legal understanding to really even speak about those things.
I suspect he's fully capable.
A very deep understanding in the political world.
Yeah, I suspect David Seymour is perfectly capable of understanding all the legalities of it, but he's busy trying to get votes for his political party and progress his own career.
I think the ones to watch are really Māori women who are in Parliament right now, and they're the ones that will speak truth. Maybe sometimes not in the language that we want to hear it in, but they definitely have a very, very great understanding of where the treaty sits. And I know when I hear them speaking, those who are, you know, within that world of politics, Māori women, they're very articulate, they understand, and, you know, they see it for what it is that's being thrown, really literally thrown onto the table, which has no mana at all, and they're calling it really clearly. And I think that's something to watch, something to look out for.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, David Seymour, he does. He destroys his own mana. He has no honour. I really to do, you know, just to for own his own personal gain, his own personal political gain, to continue driving a wedge in race relations in this country is just appalling. And he's not reaching everyone, but he's reaching enough people to be a problem, I feel.
Yeah. I think that's where you divert your focus to. You might default to his way of thinking, or you can just put him to the side and say, oh, look, that's really not the issue right now. We need to focus back onto the heart of the matter. And I think that's the gift that many Māori women politicians bring to the table. They know how to bring it back to the actual core of what needs to be discussed.
He's just
providing, you know, fuel for, as you say, his individualism.
Can I to wrap up? I would like to talk about something that I'd learned, because if you've just tuned in, talking to Ngāro Noa, we were both at the recent Treaty of Waitangi workshop that Raglan Naturally put on a few weeks ago, and hopefully they'll be doing more next year, because I really, really recommend it. It was actually a very enjoyable as well as informative event. I already knew, I think a lot of people would be surprised at the dodgy behaviour from the government and the way that they were basically stealing Māori land. There's a lot to learn there. I've already learned a little bit about that around here from interviewing Angeline Greensill and Taruki Thompson, so I was a little bit aware of that already. What I wasn't aware of was the pre-treaty life in this country, and it was actually what I got from that was such a positive vision, and I felt like I needed a positive vision. I felt quite emotional about it. Māori and Pākehā were working together. They were trading and swapping technology and information, and English people were learning Māori to participate in the life here, and it was a much more positive vision. And I felt really strongly about that. That was completely new to me, because we'd focused so much on what happened after the treaty and what happened after it and the betrayal.
That's a good word, betrayal. That did happen, and it continues to happen. So yes, you know, Māori were absolutely all for this trading relationships with the colony.
Yeah.
That work was going on. One of the paramount chiefs in Ngāpuhi, Te Pahi, was instrumental in developing those relationships long before the treaty.
Yeah. But I think
and it was a really important part of the growth of that relationship, saying like, yeah, by all means, come, we want the school base that you have, and we have resources that you want as well. You know, the Kauri was a classic example of that. Much of the Kauri forest, or not much, but a significant amount, went to San Francisco.
Right, yeah.
Mm. So there was a sharing of resources. That's the sacred Kauri. That was shipped off to San Francisco. So there was this genuine desire to expand for Māori and to adapt and adopt.
Yeah, and it was like we always need a sense of hope. We need something to feed our sense of hope that we can resolve these problems and that we can go into the future in a positive way. And just even though that was, over 150 years ago, the pre-treaty time, it does give me a sense of hope to see that there was a positive relationship and that these things are possible.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can do this. These treaty workshops will also have a part to play in that, the education of people, and because we have such a beautiful, time within our own community experiencing that learning together, that's where going forward we'll, have that positive inspiration.
Yeah, yeah. And I was thinking, I don't know what's taught to people and young people in school these days, but for young Māori people to be aware of that time and that vision, I think must be really empowering.
Yes, yes. Well, a lot of effort is put into, now that we've got, kura kaupapa Māori and Māori at the tertiary level, so there's that whole rounded education of being bicultural and bilingual is, a founding, a whāriki, if you like, for not only Māori, but for all of us to have two languages and have fluency in them, so you really know what you're talking about when you come up to these historical documents that are the founding documents of our country.
Yeah, and people can go see them in Wellington, along with the How many people voted for women's suffrage that women could vote? It was like a 300,000 person petition, I thought. That's also there in Wellington. People can actually see it.
Yeah, there's a lot of work that's been done, and it's keep on reminding ourselves that there have been these historical, you know, coming together and desiring to work together in partnerships is you know, something in us that we want to continue to nurture.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. All right, so I don't know, any last thoughts about the treaty workshop you enjoyed? I mean, did you learn anything, or did you know pretty much all of this?
Oh, no, I learned heaps.
Yeah.
I learned heaps, and I really enjoyed it. I just enjoyed the experience. I've not been to that situation. I've been mainly in what they call the Waitangi Tribunal settings, and they're quite different.
Yeah.
They've got, you know, like,
very serious
lawyers and
quite a different
different focus. It's always about fighting them, fighting them with legal words.
All right. Well, look.
And for those who will look out for the next round of treaty workshops and put your name down and go along, you'll find it really rewarding.
Yeah, and it's only $20. I'm pretty sure they're not doing another one this year, but they were talking about doing some more next year. Is it such a positive experience for the people who participate? I'm sure they will.
I hope so.
Yeah, yeah. Okay,
yes, absolutely.
Thank you very much for your time this morning. Hopefully we'll see you in 2 weeks' time in the studio again.